I'd never seen anyone die. I'd seen death, its after effects, but never the instant of transformation. In retrospect, I thought I should have felt more. At the time, I only worried about myself. At least, I thought I did. Later, I realized I was mistaken. I didn't think about myself. I only thought about Charlotte. I worried for her, and I felt anger for anyone who dared to threaten her. In some unusual, dislocated space, I'd accepted that we were all about to die. I felt okay about that, for myself. But I was furious that Charlotte would be hurt, would vanish through the whirling darkness I now saw rising from the room below. That had me angry enough to be on my feet, to care, to want to do something. Electricity, a novel bigger than the universe. Written and read by Mike Bartlett. Episode 2, The Quiet Office. When I arrived back in London, it became impossible not to realize how vague my plans had been. In Italy, returning had seemed merely the sensible thing to do, as if life was waiting here to wrap itself around me. Details such as accommodation and work didn't seem important in the context of the life I had planned out, or dreamed out, at least. As always, I checked my luggage into a locker, having disembarked the Eurostar at Waterloo, and went to claim a bed at a hostel. London locations were still something of a mystery to me, so it had been a toss-up between a hostel in Earl's Court or Epping. Randomly, and ultimately fortunately, I chose Earl's Court and found a stiff little bed in a 5-bed room. It was £15 a night. By my estimates, I could afford to stay no longer than a week, but I comforted myself with the thought there was an uncle in Hammersmith and an aunt in the country somewhere. I'd met the uncle once, and the aunt not at all, and, as it was, neither offered accommodation. I felt it too early in our acquaintance to push the matter. After these fruitless phone calls, I stared at the pornographic postcards plastered around the phone booth and considered my options. There were none. I would have to find work and accommodation, or I'd be breakfasting with the other wankers in the park. On reflection, there was another option, but it wasn't one that heralded any hope. In the back of my journal, I'd sticky-taped a scrap of paper an old flatmate had given me, the email address of a friend of his. We'd met once at a pub, which at the moment made him as real and valid as my oldest of friends. With a rare display of forethought, I'd emailed him from Milan and announced my impending arrival in London. He replied and left the phone number of his sister's in Wimbledon. This was Tom. When we met for our first drink that evening in the Blackbird, just up the road from my hostel, there was no inkling as to the depths of madness and sanity we would dredge together. But then, I suppose, there never is. Tom was tall, as was the case with most of my friends. A girl of whom I once saw a lot for 2 weeks, and little thereafter, brought this to my attention. Peered up at us and asked if I knew anyone short and unattractive. The answer was yes, of course, but never for long. Another personality defect appeared on the x-ray, another blemish on the scan. I only looked more deeply at those superficially attractive. Only checked the ingredients on something that already whetted the appetite. I worried about karmic irony, a disfiguring car accident or condition, but only briefly. I had height and good bone structure, and it didn't occur to look elsewhere for anything less. "You're 3 days late," was the first thing he said to me, leaning against a phone booth. The second, in an equally brisk fashion, was, "Glad you're a smoker." "Didn't think you looked like one," he explained, holding open the pub door. "Always more fun in good company." "Mutually assured destruction," I smiled. deciding then to drop the casual and venture closer to addiction. And I'm always late, I added. Tom, whose shoulders heaved as he laughed, did look like a smoker. He had the drawn, caricatured appearance of the partially baked. Ink lines on the cheeks and charcoal under the eyes. His hair was styled and chaotic, oiled or oily, and his hands trembled when easing the next smoke from the pack. We already had that much in common. He'd been in London 3 weeks, and had a sister and several friends about the place. His work was financial and vague in nature. I had some idea he was once employed by a bank, and this was the means to the sprawling holiday on which he was embarked. He'd climbed the Andes, skied the Alps, and trekked the Pyrenees. As a result, he'd arrived in London on crutches, which was perhaps unsurprising, given his general level of fitness. Where I took my exercise running for the bus, Tom took cabs, and only walked to the pub, his trim physique attributable to the nervous energy that rendered him restless until drunk. As we found our first table, Tom limping on his right foot, his head twitched about on his shoulders, as if checking for witnesses. "How long are you planning to stay?" he asked. I checked my bare wrist, my watch in a box somewhere in Perth, and counted out the hours to 11. I had my reasons for not wanting to return to the hostel. Her name was Anne. For the last 3 nights we'd been having illicit and uncomfortable sex in the hostel toilet. The rim of the basin was becoming indelibly imprinted on my backside. I was keen to avoid a repeat performance this evening. Having considered this, I realized I'd misunderstood. I'm not thinking about going back, really. Girlfriend? None to speak of. Why not? His directness caught me off guard. Women think I'd treat them badly, I said, which was mostly true. Do you? Well, don't we all? Good, good, he said firmly, as if this concluded a much longer discussion. It was the businessman in him. Sealing a deal with a minimum of fuss. "It'll be good to have you around," he added, already hastening to the bar. When he returned, he'd remembered another question. "Meant to ask, you're here why, exactly?" "To get famous," I said in a blunt fashion that might have been mistaken for irony. "Not too fussed about the fortune. And you?" "To make shitloads and then bugger off without paying any tax," he said, just as bluntly. Within a pint, we were chatting in a familiar and offensive fashion, despite having little in common but height, trembling hands, and a shared manner in which we took our booze, copiously and determinedly. On that first night, a quiet night, we drank 10 pints across 4 different pubs. Tom's restlessness continued. Within a couple of pints, he was always ready to be somewhere else. I tried to decide what endeared a pub to him. It seemed he'd found little to like in the Irish franchise, nor a pub clumsily themed around a famous painting, nor a noisy bar of suits and glass, nor a Mexican place. I didn't realize then he wasn't looking for women, music, or a local scene. He was just looking for the next thing, the next drink. Maybe I was restless too. We were both determined not to notice we were strangers. We worked at humor, talking frantically, laughing determinedly. We called each other by our surnames, as if to exaggerate this distance into something shared. "Mr. Summerfield, Mr. Hensley." There were already things we agreed on, in a beery, earnest fashion. We weren't tourists here. We weren't going to work behind a bar. We weren't going to live with other Australians. We weren't going to live 16 to a pokey basement bedsit in Earl's Court. We were both going to do things differently. We were going to be Londoners. We were going to belong here. Maybe I uttered these pledges, lighting another silk cup. Maybe it was Tom, tapping out his manifesto on the bar top. It didn't matter. We both believed it. Maybe every new migrant feels the same. Around 11, we found ourselves in the Australian theme pub, with Cold Chisel on the stereo. We stood with our backs to the bar, both flushed with booze, hair askew, matching cigarettes on our bottom lips, and watched our countrymen in silence. Groups of them huddled and swayed and sung, slopping Foster's lager across cardboard beer mats. "Look at these wankers," I said, drunk enough not to care who heard. Booze often encouraged in me an angry bravado, one I suspected would be short-lived if ever faced with the promise of imminent violence. Why come all this way to be exactly the same? To come to the same pubs, drink the same beer? Why not just stay at home? These weren't original questions. I would hear them repeated from countless lips over the next 6 months, directed at Pakistani newsagents, Hindu restauranteurs, Jewish kids in Golders Green, teenage girls in Islamic headscarves. Why come to London and bring your world with you? Why come to England if you didn't want to be English? I didn't have any answers, so it was a question I stopped listening to. Tom stubbed out his cigarette and put down his pint glass. "Let's never drink here again." I agreed, and decided then that we were friends. On Tom's first day at work, he loaned me his mobile phone. I forget why. It must have been a Wednesday, as it was in the pocket of my new leather jacket, while I spread pennies between record stores. Plastic pennies. Harrods were yet to pay me, so I was living off my credit card, flattening myself with interest as I pulled tens and twenties from cash machines to eke out on 3-litre bottles of cider and 10p lentil soup. The statements were still arriving at my mother's, so I did my best at denying them. I was hemorrhaging money I was never going to have, with little chance of stopping soon. There were travel cards, phone connections, electricity bills, cigarettes, groceries, and booze, especially booze. I took the pain from impending penury and substituted glamour. I was already calculating meals and bills in terms of pints and four-packs. I knew a minicab from Piccadilly was 2 pints or a 4-pack of Stella. A bus to the city was 5 cigarettes, a daily pass 20 silk cup. I wondered if this economy was something I should start worrying about. But not often. We'd been in the flat a week, after a week and a half of searching and 2 weeks of waiting through renovations. The money I didn't have vanished down the side of my stiff Earl's Court mattress. Searching had been a frustrating and mostly fruitless endeavour, spending several mornings and afternoons poring over loot and cigarettes at Tom's sister's flat, phoning people who, for the most part, seemed to have gone on holiday. Tom spoke to an Egyptian woman who didn't speak any English for some long minutes before she was replaced by her gruff husband, who demanded, "Do you like to smoke?"
"Well, yeah, but never inside."
"No cancer in my house. Goodbye." The beeps. That morning I'd already spoken to a woman in her 40s who asked if I was clean. For a moment I thought she was referring to drug habits. "I'm sorry? Are you a clean person?" I felt this question could only be answered in the affirmative. "What I mean," she continued, "is, are you obsessed with cleanliness? Because I'm very bohemian, you see." I mumbled something about not liking to drown my own filth, but suspected the next question would probe my attitude to sharing a room with 6 cats. She said to turn up whenever, and I decided to wait until the time felt right. I believed this would be a while. Later there was a woman from Thamesmead. Neither Tom nor I could find this in his mini A to Z, but the advertised house sounded ideal, large enough for 6, with a rent that would only demand 3. I called to inquire about location. The woman who answered was aggressively cockney. "Yeah? Hi, I'm ringing about the house you have advertised in Thamesmead."
"What?"
"The house in Thamesmead."
"I heard you."
"Right, sorry. Can you tell me where Thamesmead is?"
"What?
Where is Thamesmead?"
"Berwick Road."
"No, Thamesmead. Where is it?"
"What do you mean?"
Where in London is Thamesmead?"
"London?"
This continued for another minute, during which time I began to suspect the woman had no idea where Thamesmead was. Maybe she'd lived within its confines her entire life and had no idea of its geographic position. Maybe she knew nothing of the world outside it. Perhaps it didn't exist. I tried again. "Is it to the east or west of London?"
"What?
East or west?" There was a pause before a reluctant,
"East."
We were getting somewhere now. "Right, north or south?"
"South. Southeast."
Okay. Can you give me the name of a surrounding suburb?
Oh.
It seemed I'd caught her out. I became sure the whole place was a cruel fiction, designed to trick tourists. Come to fictional Thamesmead. No clues.
What's it near?
The woman mumbled a place name. She might have had her palm over the mouthpiece. Sorry. She mumbled the name again. It sounded like... Sorry? There was the rustle of tinfoil, as if to give the effect of static on the line. I listened for giggling, conspiratorial whispers, then looked to Tom, exasperated. He drew a finger across his throat, and I killed the line. We wandered through Southwark, Pimlico, Vauxhall and Brixton, looked at pokey apartments on red brick estates, and turned our noses up at ex-council flats. Avoided addresses that led to the Jenga tower blocks of Wandsworth. Having exceeded my ration of cigarettes the previous evening, I bummed several from Tom.
It's okay, because I know they're coming back to me, he said,
in the tone of a loan shark thinking about my kneecaps. The morning was warm and clear, but filled us only with heat and despair. A line of sweat formed on my hairline and a curl on my lip. I wasn't bleeding half my wage into a paisley-lined concrete shoebox miles from the tube. I said as much to Tom, but neither of us were convinced. Abandoning our attempts after lunch and binning our biro-savaged loot, we walked from Vauxhall towards Chelsea, hoping to find a pub. Instead, we found a flat in Battersea on the Queenstown Road, its door open and a for lease sign tied to its railings. The exterior was Victorian terraced house, its white paint well-grimed and flaking. A first-floor balcony come window box was crumbling, concrete and dust gathering outside the basement flat below. The green front door led to a little foyer and a lot of yellowing mail, beyond which a plain, haphazardly white door opened onto stairs from which carpets had recently been torn. Each step, pocked with old paint and pulled nails, complained beneath our boots as we followed the agent's voice showing around a young couple in suits. The couple arrived at the top of the stairs as the agent, a short Greek man with an impatient, flustered air, opened a door there onto a rear balcony. As he spoke, they smiled, nodded, and clasped each other's hands. I despised them for their better odds at tenancy. The agent eyed two Australians in crumpled T-shirts, hair unwashed, and skin shiny with last night's booze, and coughed discouragingly in the direction of the lounge. Dust rose from the floorboards as we trod through. We found two busty and bronzed Australian girls, completing the contract, and wondering aloud how soon they might move in. They didn't look at us. I quickly came to despise them, too. Tom clicked his fingers at me with some urgency.
Biro, Mr. Summerfield, biro.
I eased one from my jeans and handed it across. Snatching a contract from the pile, he quickly, and, I suspected, competitively, began filling out a form on the windowsill beside the girls. His tongue appeared at the corner of his mouth, and he barely paused to invent employment for the two of us, determined to finish first. "Don't you want to have a look at this place?" I suggested. He gave the room a cursory glance. "Why, looks perfect." His biro dried, he licked its tip and continued. A flake of plaster detached from the ceiling and appeared on the tip of his nose, but he ignored it. I glanced about the floor's bad dentistry and the wall's eczema and wondered about Tom's definition of perfection. The bathroom was lino, mould, and a plaque-ridden bathtub, over which a shower nozzle rusted. Bare stairs led up to two large and no less naked rooms, one of which overlooked several double-deckers and a queue at the lights, the other a small overgrown garden and Battersea Park Station.
"Convenient for transport!"
the agent shouted, as I noted three trains had distressed the smudged window panes within the last minute. We stood on the tarmacked rear balcony, which appeared partially melted, sloping away to the garden some 8 feet beneath. The suited couple had made their exit, and we were alone apart from an old park bench, a table, and a steel barrel of leaves and dirty water. From inside came a cry of triumph as Tom completed our contract and held it aloft. He stepped out onto the balcony, calm and professional, and shook the agent's hand.
Tom Hensley, good to meet you. This is my business associate, Aston Summerfield.
The agent cast a hurried, careless eye over the form, not bothering to introduce himself.
You both work in finance?
It was hard to tell if he was impressed. A flustered hand held a handkerchief to his brow. He noted we were both non-smokers and, with a pack of Marlboro Lights playing in Tom's back pocket, looked doubtful.
I'll expect to hear from you in the next 24 hours, Tom instructed.
I wondered if he was playing it too cool and grinned genially over his shoulder. This seemed to trouble the agent.
Well, there's been a lot of interest, he warned, or complained. Well, obviously, we've looked at a lot of places, but this would best suit our purposes. Money's no object.
I considered that were money no object, I'd be eyeing one of the austere mansion apartments across from the park, rather than a small, decaying flat, freshly divorced from squatters. The agent muttered something else, but that was lost beneath the roar and rattle of a passing train. Tom flinched at its approach, as if fearing an attack.
What's council tax like in this borough? He asked when recovered. There's been a lot of interest,
the agent said again, this time a dismissal, and moved inside towards the busts and the bronze. Tom punched the air, victorious.
I was doubtful, but had no desire to spoil the mood.
We crossed the bridge into Chelsea and took a liquid lunch at the Red Lion. Drank 3 pints each at an outside table. Tom was in good enough spirits to buy my second.
I know it's coming back to me, he said,
thinking of my kneecaps again. I quickly sidestepped all mental calculations of debt. My spirits couldn't take it.
That place is meant to be ours, Tom swooned. I can feel it. It's a done deal.
If it's not condemned first. I didn't even see a kitchen.
It was through the door past the bathroom.
I thought that was a cupboard.
Well, it might have been. Once. We'll have to take turns, but think of the location.
It's between a highway and a rail yard.
It's practically Chelsea. I'm telling you, we're in there.
When we didn't hear from the agent within 3 days, Tom called. He was met with some confusion on the other end of the line. The secretary could be heard dragging the agent to the phone.
Hello?
He said reluctantly, quickly adding, I can't talk for long. Tom explained the purpose for his call in a brisk fashion. Further confusion may have ensued due to his referring to the flat as the South Chelsea pad.
There's been a lot of interest, the agent mumbled. Listen,
Tom said firmly.
We're all professionals. I need firm answers here. I can say you're on the shortlist, or will be. At which end? I'll let you know as soon as we make any decision. Don't worry about calling again.
Tom put the phone down and looked impassively into the middle distance. This brought his attention to 3 white shirts on hangers across the top of his sister's bedroom door. His hand went to his neck and twitched there as if tightening a knot.
You're an actor, aren't you?
I'd forgotten this, but nodded anyway.
When's your Harrods interview?
He demanded. Well, I haven't arranged one. I thought I'd just walk in. Catch them off guard.
You got a suit?
I informed him of the charity shop Pinstripe had picked up the day before, for funerals and recruitment.
Make it tomorrow,
he instructed, and brought his fist down on the tabletop. His cigarettes jumped into my lap, which seemed fortuitous. I was still to buy a new packet, deepening my nicotine debt, along with every other. There were only 2 left, which seemed too few to bum one until I eyed the duty-free carton torn open on the bookshelf. The next morning we arrived promptly after 9 at the estate agent's in Vauxhall. Rode the tube against the traffic in full suit. We were freshly shaved and, for once, our hair was fixed back in an approximation of order. Tom swung a black leather briefcase about, in which 20 Marlboro Lights and a pack of Monster Munch slithered. I wore a blue trilby I'd bought in Prague, which, with the suit, gave me the appearance of a 1960s private detective. This pleased me. Tom had 3 suits to choose from, but he looked the same in all of them, as if the threads failed to disguise his inner dishevelment. I was to do the talking, and I was to do it in the received pronunciation.
Good morning!
I doffed my hat at the receptionist. It was slightly too small for me, and failed to sit correctly on replacement. I removed it and placed it in an armpit. I wondered aloud if it might be possible to discuss a pressing matter with the agent. The receptionist smiled uneasily, and slipped away to find him. He emerged 2 minutes later with a tie loose, and a handkerchief at his forehead, as if having recently received tragic news.
Yes, yes, is this important?
I explained the situation in my newly poshed-up tones. We needed to secure accommodation at the soonest juncture. We had important clients and needed a contact address. We were sure he was a busy man, but he had to understand we were professionals too, and we were working to a timetable. I flattered the bugger while applying downwards pressure in the politest manner. Within a minute, the agent's attitude had changed. Where before he had seen tourists, he now sensed class, status, money. He liked the cut of our suits, and felt his own status drop under the weight of my forged accent. The social scale tipped in our favour, and he smiled. Returning to his office, into which we were quickly invited, he produced the lease. While we signed it, he promised renovations would be completed within the week, and inquired if we needed any furniture.
Just two double mattresses and a settee, I instructed. And perhaps a dining table for entertaining. Nothing special. Perhaps oak?
He nodded, made a note of this, and handed over the keys. Tom went to the pub with them, clattering in his case. I went to Knightsbridge, where Harrods gave me a job. London liked me that day. I staggered back to Earl's Court in the early hours of the morning, and thought how nice it would be not to have to share a room with the beard and the belly for much longer. I let an alcoholic coma embrace me, and I fell giddily into it, listening to him gently farting in his sleep. Tom called me twice on his mobile before I noticed, emerging from South Kensington Tube with two missed calls. I checked the messages. The first was short.
I'm in trouble. Got no idea what I'm doing.
The second was shorter.
Mason's Arms, 6.
It was already 4:30. I quickly finished my pointlessly expensive shopping. I was determined to find a decent leather jacket with a zip, and returned to Battersea, where Tom was already waiting with 2 pints of Stella and a fresh pack of Marlboro Lights. He was trembling, but this was no sure sign of distress. More reliable a signal were the offered cigarettes and the free beer.
I'm in trouble, he said. You've got to help me out.
Tom had worked a few contacts, friends from home, already safely employed, with no success, before applying for a job he found in the financial section of the Times. The position was accounts manager for an imports company in Canada Square, the vast and modern shaft of glass and steel that centred the new Dockland city of Canary Wharf. The pay was ridiculous, quadrupled the pittance I was making at Harrods. At the interview, Tom listened carefully to the lists of skills and attributes the successful candidate should possess, and, realizing he possessed none of them, instead displayed a talent for fiction. 2 hours later, the company phoned him with an offer. He would be head of a crucial department and required to work without supervision, all of which sounded appealing. His precise duties and responsibilities were touched on so slightly then that Tom suspected they must have already been made clear to him. He hoped the bluff that had secured him the position might also ease him into it. On his first day, he arrived 5 minutes early, quite by coincidence, and used those minutes to draw vitamins from a Marlboro Light. The building, in which his office was located 14 floors from the pavement, was impressive in an unashamedly modern fashion, steel and glass scraping the low cloud. A light blinked at its apex, visible from Fulham to Hackney, Brixton to Primrose Hill. Later I used that light like a beacon, finding my bearings in a city that had none. The rest of Canary Wharf was grand and spacious, and had little place in London, seemingly grafted from across the Atlantic. Somewhere, a piece of Manhattan was missing. Tom liked it. It had the air of the city he had expected to find here, one ripe with the promise of money. He stamped out his cigarette and straightened his tie, knowing his bank account would thank him. I don't remember what the company was called, but he found it easily enough, having been issued with a swipe card at the front desk. This he attached quite proudly to the front of his jacket, hoping it lent him a professional air that might buy him some time. The office took up a third of the 14th floor, but could have coped with less. There were a dozen desks scattered about the floor with a few partitions, giving the impression of separate departments. At these desks were sat young men around Tom's age, who looked up somewhat guiltily as he entered, as if caught out. A few shuffled papers, some scratched stubble to give the impression of consideration.
Someone coughed. In the background, Tom could hear the hum and chunder of a photocopier. He looked for a spare desk, but saw none. Had a discomforting flash of looking for friends in the schoolroom. A telephone buzzed, and everyone present looked about, as if puzzled by the sound. A serious young woman in square glasses and a feathered blonde haircut approached with a clipboard. Tom assumed her to be a supervisor.
Mr. Hensley?
That's right.
I'm Claire, your secretary.
Whose secretary?
Your secretary.
What do you mean, my secretary?
Tom demanded.
Claire shifted her feet. If she was uncomfortable, it read as irritation.
Perhaps we should continue this conversation in your office?
My office?
Claire blinked and double-checked her clipboard. Sorry, you are Tom Hensley, aren't you?
I think so.
The new accounts manager.
Tom wished he'd checked his position description again before coming in.
Maybe he'd misread the title.
He decided to bluff it out. The new accounts manager, that's right. Just surprised they gave me a secretary. Already, I mean. Like to pick my own. Sure you'll do. He grinned uncomfortably. Claire didn't return the smile. Something sour in her cheek. She tipped her head towards her right shoulder.
Your office?
And my office. Like to get a feel for a place first. Looks good. He followed Claire through a wooden door to a glass-walled room that afforded a view of Greenwich, the Isle of Dogs, and a construction crew putting the final touches on the Millennium Dome. It was the first time Tom had seen it, and from this height, it barely impressed him. Half a boiled egg and a few toothpicks. The office was no more impressive. A desk, a chair, a telephone, and a computer. But, given that it was his first, he was overawed. Momentarily thrilled, and immediately fearful. At this level, it would be harder to pretend he had any idea what he was doing. Claire asked him how he took his coffee, closed the door behind her, and he was aware of his colleagues watching him through the glass, twitching like a bug in a jar. He grinned again, and sat down at his desk. He tried the drawer, but it was empty. Picked up the phone, then apologized to Claire for the interruption.
Make that 2 sugars,
he added, trading apology for authority.
You said to.
3 then. Big day. Got a lot of catching up to do.
He put the phone down. His fingers drummed on the desk, and his head shifted on his neck. With nothing better to do, he turned on the computer. Hoped some clues could be found there. A position description, some policies, a portfolio. Some spreadsheets he could copy as templates. There was nothing but an empty documents folder and an internet connection in front of a company logo. Tom tried the drawer again, in case he'd missed something. He hadn't. Claire brought him his coffee, which was sweeter than he would have liked. He grinned at her, hoping for a prompt. Any clues? That sourness was unmoved from her right cheek. Tom took off his jacket and rolled up his sleeves, held his hands and bare wrists over the keyboard, willing them to work, willing preternatural knowledge into his fingers. Instead, they merely trembled. Some minutes passed with difficulty. Looking away from his blank screen, Tom realized he was being scrutinized by a young man with inch-long red hair. His guilty grin returned and he straightened his tie. The young man blinked and smiled in an awkward fashion, snapping out of a reverie. He instantly began shuffling papers on his desk, stared at his computer screen, and moved the mouse around on his desktop. Needing something to do, Tom picked up the phone again.
Claire, I'm guessing I just do the usual to dial out.
Well, I guess it's the usual, yes.
Faced with such dedicated unhelpfulness, Tom struggled.
I'm guessing you're guessing my usual is your usual?
You dial 0 first, if that's what you want to know.
Excellent. Always worth checking. Thank you for your help.
Tom dialed his mobile, but it was underground somewhere near Piccadilly. He left his curt message for me. More minutes passed, no more easily. Tom watched the clock on the wall and divided the hours until a reasonable lunch into a series of units. Vacant units he hoped to fill with the illusion of preoccupation. He stared at his screen, called his mobile again, which was now hurtling beneath Notting Hill Gate. He began compiling a resignation letter, which he immediately deleted.
That bought him a few units. He had too much nervous energy to do nothing for long. He was shaking in his chair. A cigarette break bought him 20 minutes. 1 1/3 unit. On his way back in, he tried taking the stairs to eke it out, but gave in, shuddering breathless at the second floor. He smiled at Claire, and paused conversationally by her desk.
You worked here long, Claire?
Long enough?
Yeah, long enough. Guess you've seen a few account managers come in and out.
Guess I have.
Guess you'd know their job about as well as they do.
He laughed in a jocular fashion. Claire said nothing, smiling tightly. Tom persisted.
Guess you'd have seen what works, what doesn't.
Her smile remained intact.
Maybe we could kind of compare notes, you know, just make sure we're on the same page. Want to get off to a flying start, if you know what I mean.
Claire knew what he meant, better than he had hoped. You want me to tell you how to do your job? Tom started, his right arm jerking involuntarily into half a salute.
No, well, no. No, no, no. Well, I mean, well, no. Just wanting to touch base. Suss out the pitch. Obviously, if you've got any suggestions.
I'm a secretary. If they want to pay me to be an accounts manager, they can pay me to manage the accounts. If you want to answer the phones and make the coffees instead, maybe we can come to an arrangement.
Well, I could make one cup of coffee and maybe you could give me one hint. We could work out some sort of exchange system.
Claire laughed, and Tom started again. The laugh was sharp, singular, and entirely lacking humour. She instantly returned her attention to the magazine open on her desk. David Beckham peered out, his hair beaded like a Jamaican. Tom managed a laugh of his own, lightly, trying to dismiss his inquiry as a joke, and returned to his office. He circled his desk, as if hoping a different perspective might shed some light on his situation. The light, ultraviolet tubes overhead, was the same from every angle. He took his jacket off again and draped it over the back of his chair. He stood by the window, trying to look thoughtful, was distressed to find himself unable to think anything. His mind was completely empty. He badly needed a drink. Sitting down again, he found several of the desk clerks staring at him. He gave a small wave, and they blinked in unison, and returned to their desktops, shuffling papers or mice. Tom gave his own mouse a twirl, and made a mental note to bring in some papers of his own tomorrow. He then typed this note up, and sent it to his Hotmail account. This took 2/3 of a unit to accomplish. In a minute, he sent a second note, suggesting the immediate purchase of a hip flask. After a long lunch, he approached Claire again.
Guess I should go introduce myself to the manager.
I guess you should.
Where's his office?
Down the corridor to the left.
Right.
He turned left, wondering why he hadn't thought to report in before. Worried the manager might have expected him at 9. Worried that discipline might be in order. He found the door branded Ian Robertson, General Manager, but found it locked. He rapped on it twice and waited. After a minute, he rapped again. He pressed his ear to the door in case his manager was softly spoken. After another minute, he returned to Claire. No luck? She asked, not looking up.
The door was locked.
He's not in today.
I see.
You didn't ask.
I see. Another coffee, Claire.
How many sugars?
I'll let you know when I decide.
Tom closed his door behind him. This was promising. The manager would tell him what to do when he returned tomorrow. There was nothing to do today but kill time. He couldn't be expected to work without instruction. All would be made clear tomorrow. The next morning, the door was still locked. Tom tried it again, rattling the handle on his arrival, pressed his ear to the glass, straightened his tie and strode back down the corridor, past Claire. He's not in, she said, not looking up from her magazine. Closing his door behind him, the full horror of his day confronted him. 8 hours of nothing, keenly observed by his workmates. 8 hours of miming at the keyboard. He felt sweat dampen his poorly ironed collar, his neck uncracked. Taking his seat and rolling up his sleeves, he again met the gaze of the red-headed bloke through the glass. They shared faintly embarrassed smiles. Tom thought he could sense some empathy there, and hoped he was right. He could do with a friend. I hadn't been much help in the Mason's Arms, knowing little of finance and caring less. We turned our attention, after a suitable intake of Cronenberg, to two brunettes at a neighbouring table, from whom I then utterly failed to bum any cigarettes. Tom needed an ally in the business, so watched this uncomfortable-looking bloke over the top of his monitor, and followed him to the water machine as casually as indecent haste would allow. "Tom Hensley," he announced, jutting a palm out as his new acquaintance poured his second cup of water, a cup he would sip as slowly as his first. "James MacDonald," his co-worker winced, swapping his cup from right to left hand. "Irish." "That's right. Australian." "For my sins, you've been here long?"
"Long enough."
"Yeah, long enough. Know what you mean.
You're one of the big boys, yeah?"
"Accounts manager, so they tell me." He laughed. James winced again. He was seeming no less uneasy, glancing guiltily at the carpet. Tom persisted. "So, what do you spend your day doing?" The Irishman blinked. A tick bothered the corner of his mouth.
"Why? What have you heard?"
"No, I mean your job. What do you do here?"
A worried, flickering smile. "Well, you're the manager, aren't you?"
Yeah, but I'm finding my feet, you know, getting my bearings vis-a-vis the workload delegation."
"Well, I mostly deal with imports in a clerical capacity."
"But what do you do with them?"
"With what?"
"The imports."
"We import them.
I'm sure I don't need to tell you. Sorry, I think my phone's ringing."
It wasn't, but he went anyway.
Tom remained by the water cooler, no better informed, and still without allies. Several of his co-workers watched him, stood alone, but only briefly, quickly returning to hunching over their desktops. Tom watched them some minutes longer, waiting for one of them to do anything he recognized as work. He waited. All he recognized was Hotmail hurriedly closing on half a dozen computer screens. Returning to his office, he wondered if anyone in the office knew why they were here. Perhaps he wasn't alone in this ignorance. This thought comforted him. If no one was working there, there was no impetus on him to buck the trend. He lifted his phone for another coffee to nurse his hangover. He dialed his mobile, only for it to ring in his jacket. I was working. Several days passed in this fashion. Tom oscillated between fearful depression, occasionally waking in the middle of the night, sweating dread, and elation. Filling his days with nothing grew easier every day he managed it, and he thought it could be a career. But this was underscored by a grim anticipation of discovery and ensuing retrenchment. The drink made it easier, and I was happy to help him in this regard. We drank like Olympians, at home and away. I began to think awaking in the grip of a post-booze sickness was the traditional manner in which to open the day. Mornings were meant to arrive like a small death, and pass sluggishly until noon. Breakfast was not unusually a coffee and a cigarette. For Tom, these hangovers gave shape to the day, marked the morning in stages of caffeine and recovery, and delineated the afternoons in preparation for an evening's drinking. The day took him away and back to the pub via a precise count of Marlborough, Alka-Seltzer, and coffee cups. On the third day of his second week, the phone on his desk rang. This surprised him so greatly that he quickly shut the soft porn site he was studying. He peered through the glass to see if he could expect Claire on the other end, but she was still away fetching coffee. His hand hovered a moment over the receiver, and then drew back. The phone rang out, and he was deeply relieved. When it rang again in a moment, he felt obliged to answer it, its trilled tone troubling his headache.
"Yes? Is that the accounts manager?"
Tom felt too hungover to tell the truth, so he went with his instincts.
"He's on leave," he said. "In Africa."
And the phone went down. It stayed down until the following morning. Tom was in the grip of a worse, shudderingly horrific hangover, his head resting on the desk to keep both still. He groaned as the phone rang, and was too hungover to remember the lie.
Is that the accounts manager?
Tom Hensley, yes. I was told you were in Africa.
Tom groaned again.
Came back. Got malaria.
At that moment, he found it easy to imagine how that might feel.
Mr. Hensley, my name is Eric Court, and I'm calling from Grafton Knob's accounts payable.
This meant nothing to Tom, but it didn't seem appropriate to mention it.
Yes? We need you to authorize payment on an invoice dated 23rd of July.
Tom considered his options. There wasn't a precedent for action of any type. He had hoped to avoid any decisions for some time longer.
Mr. Hensley?
Tom cleared his throat. This took some moments.
Okay. I'm sorry?
I authorize the payment.
What do you mean?
The payment? I authorize it.
I'm afraid I'll need more than that. Tom's head returned to the desk, cuddling the phone like a damp cloth.
Will you?
Well, I'll need you to sign the invoice.
Oh, yes.
Of course. I thought I already had.
After some further discussion, he persuaded the voice at the other end of the phone to fax the invoice through to Claire. Having done so, he tried to forget about this intrusion and returned to his nothingness. Mere minutes later, he was interrupted again by Claire delivering the fax to his desk. He surveyed the paper unenthusiastically.
Right, yes. A fax, good.
I assume you've seen a fax before. Her tone was sharp, but he decided not to notice.
Yep, that's definitely a fax. I recognize it.
So you don't need me to tell you what to do with it? Tom attempted a casual laugh. It became something bronchial he worried might project onto the desktop.
No, well, unless you've got any suggestions.
Claire clicked the biro she was carrying in her right hand and passed it across. She had noted the flat red patch where his forehead had spent the morning against the desk. For a moment, she almost smiled. See if this stirs any memories for you.
I don't suppose the manager's in today.
The door closed gently behind her. Tom looked at the biro, then at the paper in front of him. There was a line beneath the set of figures towards the bottom of the page. He tried to focus on it and, when that didn't work, scrawled his signature on this line, instructing Claire to return the fax to its sender. This seemed to be successful, as the rest of the day passed in a familiar sloth. When the phone rang again the next day with similar demands from a different company, he requested a fax, signed it, and returned it. He was happy with this, filled with a new pride in his work. Fears of impending unemployment faded as he now felt himself to have come to grips with his position. With the occasional twitch of a biro, he was now at the top of his trade. He authorized everything that came across his desk in a prompt and professional manner. Only occasionally did he pause to notice how large the figures above his signature were growing. Weeks passed, and his work satisfaction continued unabated. As his mood lifted, the free beers dried up, my drunken company no longer a necessary solace. It troubled me that his success at work was depleting my own finances, so I was somewhat relieved when, late September, I received another summons to the Mason's Arms. I was late, as always, and an untouched pint was waiting for me.
"I think I'm in trouble," Tom said, holding a cigarette with tremulous fingers. "I've been getting phone calls."
"Phone calls? What kind of phone calls?"
"The kind that precede concrete footwear."
"What have you done?"
"Well, nothing. I don't understand it. All I've ever done is nothing, and it's worked fine for me."
I understood this predicament. It was hard to do nothing differently when nothing had stopped working. The first threatening phone call had arrived 2 days previously. It related to one of the invoices Tom had signed and returned last week.
"Payment has been declined," a stern voice intoned. "Fax me the invoice again," Tom suggested.
The next day the voice was complaining again. Tom promised to take the matter up with the accounts department. He saw no reason to do so immediately. It had taken months to accustom himself to his routine, and he wasn't ready yet to break it. That afternoon another voice rang, with a similar complaint. payment had been repeatedly declined. There was talk of legal action, but this was small talk compared to the threats the next 24 hours brought. One, from an aggressive Arab who a month earlier had supplied the company with a vast shipment of expensive carpet, discussed the possibility of Tom's disembowelment on the tube home from work. After a recuperative cigarette, Tom decided it was time to locate the accounts department. This didn't take long. He walked a few corridors and peered over a few dividers before Claire reminded him he was the accounts department. This concerned him. On lunch, he bought a lute to peruse the job market. I was unable to offer advice, useful only in summarizing the situation for my own amusement. You work for a company which you know nothing about, in a position you know nothing about, doing nothing with invoices you know nothing about. I shook my head. I just can't see what your problem is here. You've surrendered to fate, that's all. Best thing is keep doing nothing and let fate finish off with you. That way lies destiny. This was, I feel it necessary to add, 5 minutes after closing. The barmaids had stopped collecting the empties from our table, unable to keep up. I was more preoccupied with Cronenberg than Kismet. And if my destiny is to be an underwater feature near the tower? I shrugged. Well, we can't all be rock stars. The threats continued for some weeks, and it's fair to say that Tom suffered. London had turned its back on him. When he waited for the bus, he waited in the rain while our neighbours wore sunglasses on the other side of the road. His other friends fled the UK for the warmer comforts of home. He bought ecstasy from a dealer in Brixton and walked away with horse tranquilizers. There were domestic issues as well, stemming from a stowaway on the lounge room floor, which only heightened his discomfort. Coming home at night, I'd always turn the corner into Queenstown Road and find him stuck out the first floor window at 45 degrees, as if readied for launching, a cigarette in one hand and a beer in the other, compromising our no-smoking-indoors rule. His restless energy was approaching mania, accelerating and accelerated by his drinking. I couldn't match the mania, but was happy to match him beer for beer. It was for his good, I told myself. But it seemed to help me as well. London had cut me a few favours lately. I was on the other side of the street from him, but enjoyed the company nonetheless. On a Friday, he arrived at work to find his office had vanished. The 14th floor had been gutted. Floors bare and concrete, loose wires hanging from ceilings, door frames empty, and temporary walls removed. Tom was late, and found his co-workers gathered by the lift as wary cattle, chewing at thumbnails, hopeless and helpless.
"What's going on?"
he asked the nearest colleague, who shrugged. There were a group of half a dozen grey suits in the centre of the floor, one of whom made his way over to Tom with a clipboard. "Thomas Hensley?"
I'm sorry? Are you Thomas Hensley?
Thomas Hensley. For a moment, Tom wasn't sure, dazed by the bare walls and concrete, thinking, perhaps oddly, of the emails he'd lost on his vanished desktop. There was one from an ex-girlfriend he would rather have kept, and then he worried about the cachet of soft porn in the browser.
Are you the accounts manager?
Tom blinked. Looked at this officious suit with the impatient curl to his lip. Decided it would be prudent to make an exit.
No, I'm not, no.
You're not?
Yes, I mean, no. No, I'm not.
But you do work here.
Yes, well, I did. I cleaned the carpets.
The suit looked at Tom's own, checking out his briefcase. Seemed doubtful.
You clean the carpets? Yes, but I see there aren't any. I guess my work here is done.
Tom looked over his shoulder at the lift and edged backwards towards it. As soon as his boots touched down on the pavement outside, he dialed home on his mobile. I was busy writing or failing to, but glad of the excuse to start drinking a few hours earlier than usual. It was a clear morning and unusually warm, so we crossed the road to Battersea Park and drank at the bar by the lake. We thought it might be our last chance to catch some sun before winter descended. And we weren't alone in these thoughts. Elderly tourists splashed oars hopelessly in small wooden boats. Ducks snapped at crumbs and cigarette ash about our feet. The lawns were full of half-naked men and women sunning themselves on towels, their faces draped in newspapers. After an hour, an ambulance hurtled along one of the quiet park roads, scattering rollerbladers and tricycling children before it. This unexpected note of drama briefly took our attention away from our beers and Tom's unemployment. In half an hour, we had the story from an OAP talking to a waitress. "Two young girls dead," he said. "Struck by lightning." Tom glanced skyward. A solitary cloud passed behind the power station chimneys.
"Lightning. That makes as much sense as I now expect from this city."
I read the story the next day in a discarded newspaper. Two teenagers found beneath a tree, clasping each other's hands. To me, the tale had a certain dark romance in its mystery and fused fingers. The mystery of Tom's evaporated job occupied my interest more, but not for long. The full story was revealed 2 weeks later, when we bumped into his red-headed colleague in a Soho pub. It was the first time I heard the term the long firm. McDonald had been arrested shortly after Tom fled in the lift, the arresting detective explaining a few key facts. It was a scam, and not a new one, involving a business front that would be rapidly erected and dismantled. The business would purchase a large amount of stock from various suppliers and sources, paying the first invoice promptly and completely. This would be followed by a second, much larger order, taken in credit. This time, the bills would not be paid. The goods couldn't be traced, as no one working for the business front would have any idea what they were doing. The stock would then be sold off quickly from a warehouse, and the business would disappear without trace. Any creditors might approach those allegedly responsible for their accounts, but would see no remuneration. The police moved quickly in and quickly away, arresting and releasing the office staff within a matter of hours.
"So, I was supposed to do nothing," Tom said.
McDonald nodded. Tom sniffed. A smile flattened across his face. Much of the mania of the last few weeks seemed to leave him. The professional returned. He looked at me, grinning.
"I should have asked for a pay rise."
And he went for the next round to celebrate.